The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome, comrades, to the Top 100 Project, the every 7 days podcast that takes a long look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 compilations of the grooviest American movies. Don't be angry with us for ruining this film, but we're moments away from doing just that. I am Ryan Ellis, sitting here with my own blonde beauty who enjoys icy romantic liaisons, my wife Bev.
That's me.
So, the coming attractions trivia for Dr. Zhivago, this week's film. Dr. Zhivago didn't make very many AFI lists. It was on the 1998 Top 100 and the Top 100 Passions, but that's all. What else was it at least nominated for?
I'm going to say it had to be Epics.
That's one of them.
The second Top 100 list, mm-hmm. Of course. Anything else?
One more.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
The Top 25 Music Scores.
Oh.
This theme is very well known and in some cases very well reviled. But yeah, you got two of the threes. The Top 100 for 2007, the Music Scores, and the Epic category. Okay, the Top 100 Project's 68th movie, Dr. Zhivago, was a lofty 39th on AFI's Top 100 list in 1998 between Double Indemnity and North by Northwest, then took a monumental nosedive right off the list, although it was, as we just said, one of the 400 nominees. Dr. Zhivago premiered on December 22nd, 1965, then MGM released it on New Year's Eve. Box office-wise, this is another in our recent string of monster hits. Bev will tell you what the film's going to be about with that skinny.
Omar Sharif is Yuri Zhivago, a Russian doctor and poet who falls for the beautiful and complicated Lara, played by Julie Christie. Over many years during the Bolshevik Revolution, before and after World War I, Yuri struggles to win Lara from Komarovsky, played by Rod Steiger, and her idealist husband, Tom Courtenay. That is just the beginning.
It's a love rhombus. Three guys and one girl.
Love parallelogram.
Yeah, even better. That is just the beginning. But in a nutshell, which you pretty much just did a nutshell, this story. But my own nutshell is, attractive people let war and politics harsh the romantic buzz. All they want to do is be together, but war and politics say, nyet. All right, well then, Dr. Zhivago, it's been a little while since we saw the movie as we do the podcast today. What did you think of the film?
There are scenes and aspects of it that I really loved, and there's a lot to admire about it, but I found the experience of sitting through it mostly a chore. I love the history, the intimate depiction of the revolution, but I really found the character of Zhivago rather boring.
He is a cipher.
He's really unrealistic, too. He's just so unflappable and perfect. It makes him dull. He's not complicated enough.
I believe it's on the documentary, on the DVD, where Omar Sharif says about David Lean's direction, that he wasn't giving him enough. And he said something like he almost had a breakdown. And he doesn't say it in one of those melodramatic kind of ways, but when I heard that, I thought, oh, come on, man. A lot of times when that happens with directors, it means you're not doing anything wrong, just keep doing what you're doing and just play the character.
And maybe it was a fault of the novel as well, because David Lean directed Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai, which have leading characters that are tremendously complex and interesting. So, maybe it's the novel's fault.
Well, 85% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes, 88% of audiences. Pretty solid numbers. In fact, very solid numbers. And some more numbers here. It was 8th on Box Office Mojo's list of adjusted for inflation hits ever. $33 million bucks behind Jaws, and it's MGM's second biggest hit on that list of all time behind, of course,
Gone with the Wind.
Which is easily the biggest hit of all time.
Yeah.
8th. I'm still going to have to keep on saying that number. That's staggering to me. I knew it was a big hit, but here's some more numbers to crunch for David Lean films. Dr. Zhivago's 27th on the British Film Institute's Top 100 Flicks of the 20th Century. Lawrence of Arabia was 3rd. Bridge on the River Kwai was 11th. So the three big Lean epics were extremely well ranked. And you're saying you're not a big fan of this movie. I always thought I loved this movie for many years. I saw it again probably about 5 to 10 years ago and didn't like it as much. I think what blew me away the first time was Julie Christie, one of the most staggeringly beautiful women I've ever seen, at least in this one movie. Not that she wasn't always pretty, but in this movie, they make her look just eye-poppingly gorgeous.
And the character of Lara is really graceful and lovable.
Although, ironically, these three men who, quote-unquote, love Lara never seem to know the real her. Victor uses her for sex, Pasha is tied up in politics, and Yuri seems to be blown away more by her beauty than by her.
No, he falls in love with her when they're working together and she's his nurse. So it could be her compassion, skill, competence that made him fall in love with her.
Fair enough. We don't see the scenes where that all happens.
Yeah, yeah. It all happens off screen.
They glossed over it, and the movie's already well over 3 hours. I guess that's fair enough that they would gloss that over. Okay, so Yuri then loves her.
Yeah.
And we don't see what Pasha knew about her, which was before the movie started. He knew her from before when she's a very young girl.
Mm-hmm.
Komarovsky definitely is using her for sex.
I don't even know if Pasha loves her, though. He seems fond of her enough in the beginning, but he seems to push her aside quickly enough as soon as his politics distract him.
And poor Tom Courtenay's character doesn't even get a proper death. He just dies off screen.
Mm-hmm.
He's a major character. Just, yeah, he's gone. Yeah, he died. But I guess that's true about Laura. Here's a plot spoiler and a big one. Later on, Yuri's half-brother Yevgraf, the Alec Guinness character, says she was probably either killed or died in a labor camp.
Yeah, she was disappeared by the party.
Stalin, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I actually really loved that detail. I love the way they ended the stories in really very tragic but also matter-of-fact ways. It kind of personalized the tragedies that did take place during the revolution.
There's a key moment in the movie, maybe the key moment in the movie, the not quite ending, but the ending of the story we care about, where Yuri is feet away from touching Laura but suffers a heart attack. And she never knows he's there. She keeps on walking. She has no idea he was ever there. It's really corny. And when I liked this movie in the past, when I was a big fan of this movie in the past, I definitely bought into that. Maybe not so much in my old age. What did you think of that moment?
Well, it was one of the what seemed like hundreds of pushing it coincidences that take place in this movie that he would have finally seen Lara like minutes before he was about to die. Considering how many characters seem to continually run into each other over and over in this film, Russia's a big country, and they even, like, go all over the country, and they still keep, they just can't help but run into each other. And then she couldn't find her daughter? That seems like the least believable thing. Like, really? Because she's found Yuri, like, 3 times.
They used the very famous Laura's theme in this music, and we're going to talk about that extensively as we go through this, undoubtedly. But they could have used, "Will Meet Again."
Yeah, really.
Don't know where. Well, I do know where. Probably in Russia. And probably Russia's pretty somewhere. Soon. Because they're always meeting each other.
Don't
again.
Know when.
That is true.
Any minute now. Really soon.
Just hang around in this giant country. Yeah. You'll run into me. And that takes me back to when I was doing my pre-search on the movie before we even watched it. The complicated, extraordinarily complicated plot description on Wikipedia. It took almost an hour just to read it all. It took me forever. And I've seen the movie before. I was looking for little tidbits I could pull out to add to my notes. And if I didn't know the movie already, I would have been lost.
When you read it, you're like, how could they squeeze all this into the movie? It just keeps going on and on. And then.
Maybe that's why critics were unkind at first. Newsweek, in particular, trashed it.
They weren't alone. There was a couple other, Ebert said it lumbers noisily from nowhere to nowhere. I think he ultimately liked the film, but I really liked that line because it kind of summed up my feelings about it. Bosley Crowther said both the characters of Zhivago and Lara are possessed by a strange passivity that ruined the film for him. Pauline Kael said neither the contemplative Zhivago nor the flux of events is intelligible, and what is worse, they seem unrelated to each other. And a lot of people really hated the theme. Every review I read made some kind of catty comment about the music that persists in playing throughout the whole film.
That's true. As many people out there that love Laura's theme hate it. Hate it!
The whole time we were watching the film, it just kept making me think of music lessons, because when you learn to read music, it's a very easy song to learn. So any music lesson I ever took, Laura's theme was always in the first book that they would give you.
And the movie at first was not successful when it first came out. It took a while.
Really?
This is one of the benefits of movies back in that era. They would not be pulled out of theaters right away if they didn't succeed. And one of the reasons why this one succeeded was, much like Sound of Music, although that succeeded from the beginning, people latched onto that soundtrack album and said, let me go check that movie out after all.
Ah.
And again, Dr. Zhivago, like so many movies we've covered lately, would have had re-releases where it would have a chance to benefit and make a lot more money that way. And I'll say it one more time, 8th Box Office Mojo.
Yeah, all-time adjusted for inflation is insane. I wondered about that. Maybe it's because Lawrence of Arabia was so popular, for better reason, in my opinion. It was a better film, for sure.
Yes.
by then, David Lean would have certainly had a reputation of a director that when his movie comes out, if you want to see it, you better see it in the theater. Must see on the big screen, too. You're not going to wait for it to come out on TV because you know that his films deserve to be seen in big screen. It was shot on 70mm,
this
right?
One wasn't.
It wasn't.
Interestingly, this one was not, even though the other ones, or at least Lawrence certainly was. This is Metrocolor. We said MGM made the movie. We haven't done them so much lately. After so many movies in the early part of the project, not so much lately. They're not a big player anymore. It's a big studio. They blew it up to 70mm. MGM didn't want to pay for it. It was too expensive. And even though he had been this hitmaker, Lean had been a big hitmaker, and this subject had been based on the Boris Pasternak novel, which was a Pulitzer Prize winner in literature for him, you got to think Lean is a moneymaker. We've talked about Spielberg's money podcast. He's another guy you put in that category. Hitchcock's another one. Maybe Christopher Nolan now, in the very modern era.
Yeah.
Guys, when they
yeah.
make movies, if they're not going to be a hit, that's the shock. If they aren't a yeah. blockbuster, that's the shock.
But maybe it was that goodwill for David Lean that got people out to the theater. But if, as you say, it was a slow burner, then you would think it would be just word of mouth. I can see people loving that love story, you know, kind of yeah. like the Jack and Rose thing. That's the type of thing that captures people's imaginations, and women go and see those films over and over again.
Well, here's maybe a big part of it too. Julie Christie was pretty new to movies, certainly as a star, and Omar Sharif was not new, but he wasn't really a star.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence of Arabia didn't make him a headlining star the way it did for O'Toole. Alec Guinness was already a star coming out of that film. Julie Christie, who's also in Nashville, a little ways in our future, playing herself, ironically, actually,
oh, wow.
in Nashville. The only other AFI film she has. She was also in Darling this same year, won the Oscar. And in a movie where I will quote this line, she slept her way to the top. You could argue she does that in Dr. Zhivago, too. She doesn't
well,
do
she
it
doesn't
the same
sleep her way to the top. She just, you know, well, sleeps with more than one around. Lover. It's over years. But she has cheated on her husband, doesn't she? Oh, yeah, she's quite the adulterer.
And here's an actress with other great credits, too. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is a movie I mentioned to you recently. Great Western that Altman directed. That's why she was in Nashville. They had a relationship from that, away from her a few years ago. The
oh,
Sarah
yeah.
Pauli movie.
Oh my gosh.
And there's a couple other things she's really well known for. There's the love scene with Donald Sutherland in Don't Look Now, a mm-hmm. pseudo horror film, where it's intercut where they make love and there's other scenes going on. It's something that Steven Soderbergh has done in other movies, for example. Out of Sight, he did that.
Mm.
People have said that they actually did it too, her and Sutherland. I don't know if that's true or not. And one thing I have to mention about her filmography, her applause reaction on Finding Neverland, one of my favorite moments in that entire movie, where they say, clap if you believe in fairies. And it's supposed to be aimed at all the kids in that private little show at the end of the movie. And she's the first one, the cynical grandmother, who's been a bit of a bitch, quite honestly, through the movie, that claps her hands. I love that moment. It's so
and
sweet.
Then she learns
and I
to
also
hope
read,
again.
Well, I also read, though, that Julie Christie improvised that moment, which is pretty cool.
Oh, God, I hate that movie.
I do love that moment.
We'll have though. That argument off camera, off mic.
She almost didn't play Laura, though, because Sophia Loren, it was intended
yes.
for her. The producer, Carlo Ponti, who purchased the rights, bought it so he could put his wife, Sophia Loren, in the
yeah.
film.
But then they wouldn't cast her because I think it was David Lean that said nobody would believe at the beginning of the film that Sophia Loren is a virgin.
Well, as beautiful as Julie Christie is, and I still maintain one of the most beautiful, at least in this movie, women in the history of the movies, Sophia Loren was one of the most sexy women, and yeah. It's...
Oh, yeah. Lean originally wanted Peter O'Toole to play Zhivago,
mm-hmm.
but he turned it down.
After the experience of working on Lawrence of Arabia, he thought, nope, not doing that again. We're
yeah,
going to have this...
Imagine that, but in the snow. But, you know, remember how it was super hot? Well, now it's going to be super cold. You're going to love it. Or, like, on super hot studios with all the lights, and you're going to have to dress like it's the Arctic with fur hats.
This will be a theme because other people didn't want to work with Lean again for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematographer Freddie Young had a hard experience on the movie, but he was convinced to do it.
If you win an Oscar for something, it's got to help convince you to work with that director again.
Could be. But they went with the 16th billed actor or something like that in Lawrence of Arabia. He was not in any
wow.
way a Hollywood star. And Lawrence, and then he becomes the headliner in this film. This is his second AFI film after Lawrence several weeks ago for us. Sharif himself wanted to play Pasha initially and didn't think he would
yeah.
get to play Yuri Zhivago.
Yeah.
And then he almost had that breakdown. He wasn't directing me the way I wanted it. It was not enough for me. I shouldn't slam on him.
I know. It sounds like Lean was kind of difficult.
Lean was hard to work for someone else, Alec Guinness.
Mm.
Who'd worked with them, now it's the third time in a row, he'd worked with them on a big blockbuster epic, and he kept on working with them throughout the rest of their careers. Maybe not every time, but most of the epics that Lean made. But Alec Guinness said he was a prima donna, and they fought a lot like they did on Bridge of the River Kwai. And of course, Guinness was in that movie. He was in Lawrence. He was in this. He's still in Star Wars. What a great filmography for him. Not a huge role, and maybe not even a very important role, the bookending. We hear his voice. We see him, I think, maybe three times, the very beginning, the very ending. I think we might see him sometime in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, he meets with them in the middle when they come back to Moscow.
And fairly. Oh, that's right. Yes, we see him a few times in the story itself. That's right. He's not just a framing device. Yes. I don't really know what his role means. He's trying to find Yuri's daughter, and he doesn't even prove it in the end.
It's strange that he's a narrator, because there's so many details that he would never know.
Mm-hmm.
All this strange stuff that kind of pops up in the story, but he's supposed to be the one narrating the story of this girl, Tanya's parents.
And he doesn't, as I said, prove who she is, so maybe she's not even the right person anyway. Mm-hmm. Although, because she has the balalaika, she's got to be Yuri's daughter, so it's a gift.
But what was he going to do if he could prove that she was their daughter?
I don't know.
Shake her hand, run away.
Good to see you, blood relation. Half-blood relation. There must be something more in the Pasternak novel that we're not really aware of. The movie doesn't make as clear as it maybe could.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're just Luddites and didn't pick up on it. And I said the trivia question, I think it was going into Bridge on the River Kwai. What is Guinness's highest military rank? It was General Kenobi in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
He's a general in this film, but he's a lieutenant general, so I suppose he's a little lower ranked. But I thought I had to do a mea culpa when we were in the movie, and I heard somebody call him that. I thought, oh, I didn't know he was considered a general. The credits didn't label him as such. I hadn't seen the movie in a long time. I'd forgotten that. But, oh, I was saved by the lieutenant general part there. We talked about Rod Steiger in the very opening. He's got a pretty important role, too. Mm-hmm. Although it's debatable that this movie belongs on the American Film Institute, because he's the only American in the cast.
Yeah, I'm trying to make out what makes this an American film.
It's MGM.
It's a Hollywood studio.
And yeah. Steiger, he's by far the biggest American in the cast. And fairly highly billed. He's got a pretty important role as Komarovsky.
If you look at it on Wikipedia, Dr. Zhivago is a British film about the Russian Revolution.
Well, I said the BFI. The three lean epics are all on there, too.
Yeah.
And many of the movies do have a crossover. That's come up a few times now with the lean movies we've done lately and The Third Man, which was late last year for us.
Mm-hmm.
Movies that are very debatably American at all. We've seen Steiger twice. We're going to see him one more time, and very soon, in fact. This is his second AFI film after On the Waterfront 21 AFI years ago. Not a movie you liked either. And we're still going to see him in The Heat of the Night very soon. He did have a very nice diversity in his three AFI films. On the Waterfront, where he plays a mobster, second hand of a mob boss, I guess. But a sympathetic character. Dr. Zhivago, where he's a bully, tyrant sort of character. Not actually an American. We said he was American, but he's an American actor playing a Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Heat of the Night, he plays a bigoted Southern American cop.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets to play a little range there. Now, Lean had wanted Brando for Victor, which is interesting because Brando and Steiger have one of the most famous scenes in the history of movies in that taxi cab and On the Waterfront, but Brando turned it down, and James Mason, who actually accepted the role at one point, then he passed. I don't know why he would say yes and then no, but maybe Steiger was a good choice. Steiger used the method, the very famous method, a few times in this movie, where Julie Christie slaps him. When he kisses her too hard, he slaps her right back. Julie Christie did not know that was coming.
Oh,
and her reaction was pretty real as a result. And also when he tries to kiss her in the back of that carriage, he tries to, and she sort of pushes him away a little bit. Then he forces himself on her. She didn't know that was coming either.
Huh.
There may have been a part of her that thought, what is this jerk doing in this? David, stop him! But it was working for the role because she loathed him.
Yeah, maybe he was just a creep. Maybe he wasn't so much a method actor.
Maybe he was just my id when I first saw this movie and thought, this woman is stunning, I would do anything to kiss her. Although, naturally, the only American in the cast is the most violent person in the cast. At least with the lovely Laura.
Yeah, he's a real piece of work, his character. He's not a very kind character to anybody. He's just kind of a jerk altogether. But he's definitely the biggest jerk to Lara.
Geraldine Chaplin, Yuri Zhivago's wife in this movie, who's also going to be in Nashville with Julie Christie. Very interesting role, very daffy, strange character. You may not remember who she is when we get to that film.
I remember who she is. She's somebody very famous in a way.
Who could that be?
Especially if she's playing a daffy character. Her father is Charlie Chaplin.
That's right. She's not been in a ton of movies, but she does play his mom in the Richard Attenborough film, Long Live Richard Attenborough, who recently died. Chaplin.
Really?
Yeah, she plays her own grandmother.
Oh, I can't believe I never knew that. That's so cool.
Yeah. She has a lot of screen time in this film. She does what she can with it. She's not bad in the movie. Maybe she's only in movies because of her last name. But what'd you think of her? She's definitely the opposite of Julie Christie as far as the ferocity. She doesn't have that. She's a brunette versus a blonde. She doesn't have that same sort of outward passion. She's just a dutiful wife.
Her and Zhivago have the same problem, which is that their perfection makes them unbearably dull.
Yeah.
There's nothing to them. She doesn't even seem to get angry when she knows her husband's having a love affair with another woman.
She's just too perfect.
She's just too perfect.
Need some of Komarovsky's violence.
But he's just too bad, although he's more interesting. He's far more interesting.
Well, Tom Courtenay, we talked about him earlier. He's barely in the movie because he's out of it just out of nowhere. He becomes such a key figure in the politics of the movie, and he's just gone, killed off screen. He mostly did English productions, was in The Dresser and The Golden Compass. Not a lot of credits I could find that most people would really know, actually. But he was the only one of this cast who was nominated for an Oscar, Best Supporting Actor.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Strange.
Well, Christie won that year for Darling, so she could have been nominated for this movie anyway, and maybe wouldn't have been. The last actor to mention, Ralph Richardson. He's an English legend. Maybe not a lot of movies that the average person knows. Chimes at Midnight, the Orson Welles movie, which I watched on YouTube recently. Highly recommend it. You can find it that way. It looks pretty good, too. Watch it. It's a good film. Time Bandits and Grey Stoke, the Tarzan movie from 1984. He was in that and many other films. But he's one of those guys that if you're an English aficionado, you're going to know that name.
His name is Alexander Pasha Gromyko.
Another Pasha.
Yeah. Just in case the plot wasn't confusing enough, they just gave a couple of characters the same nickname.
She made a couple of Yuris in this movie, too.
There's two Tanyas as well.
The movie gets harder and harder. Even reviewing it, it becomes harder and harder. Fox was over in the corner, and he's appalled by all of these things, panting in the humidity of the summer.
Almost as bad as the Russian Revolution.
Well, there you go.
He was in the snow.
There you go. Let's get back to the revolution stuff. The movie does have some important subject matter in it. It aims very high, unlike My Fair Lady, for sure, and some of the movies we've seen. West Side Story is about some important topics, but certainly not affecting an entire country. This is about the birth of communism in Russia. The movie was banned for nearly 30 years. They didn't show it until 1994. In Russia, I should say. Banned for nearly 30 years.
Yeah, I think I said while we were watching the film that HUAC must have loved this film. McCarthy, mm-hmm. Well, HUAC wasn't really around anymore, but McCarthy must have just loved this one. It makes communism, and specifically Russian USSR communism, look absolutely horrible. And not even just, oh, this is how they behaved and it was wrong. It's the actual implementation of communism that is shown to be unjust and cruel.
And hurts our lovers. Damages their love.
Yeah. One of the things that drove me crazy about this movie is how much they seem to just take the revolution in stride. Not in stride, because obviously all these bad things just keep happening to them, but as it's happening, you know, he comes home from the war and his house has been taken over by the Bolsheviks, and he's like, of course it has. This is what should have happened. This is more just. And he just seems really cheerful about it. And he never gets angry about all the stuff that's happened to him and his family.
Well, somewhere in that sequence, he probably gets glassy-eyed without actually crying. Because people in this movie are constantly glassy-eyed.
Yes.
But not actually crying.
Yeah.
Men and women. Right on the verge of tears many times. Yeah, that was a theme we covered really early in the year. We've been covering it really throughout this entire year now as we get into September. Red baiting. Communism.
Mm-hmm.
The blacklist, or the gray list, even in some cases, in Hollywood. This movie doesn't have anything to do with that specifically. We've mostly come out of that era as we're in the mid-60s in our movies here. But yes, here's something that's actually about the problem that they have, which is these people can't take over and ruin the world. And yet we've got a few characters in this cast of thousands. I mean, here's a movie that actually does have a cast of thousands. Movies now don't need that many people, you just have them all digital. But this movie would have had to have had an awful lot of people. A lot of people in costume and background shots. And everything, as they show this movie shot. Also a movie that was shot internationally, worldwide. A lot of it was in Spain, but it was all over the place. All kinds of international actors, although very few Russians, ironically. Much like in West Side Story, we had very few Puerto Ricans.
Well, I guess David Lean had a better excuse, because there probably wasn't a ton of bona fide Russian actors that could defect the USSR to be in a movie, which was based on a novel that also got banned. The author of that novel, Boris Pasternak, kind of became a de facto voice against communism. He was compelled by the Communist Party to refuse his Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah, it was a 1957 novel, by the way. 8 years. Not quite as fast a turnout as some movies we've seen in the project so far, which were only a couple of years. And the Russians called him a traitor. The USSR called him a traitor.
Yeah.
Just stupid. It's just a book.
A very popular book, though. It sold a lot of copies. Although, apparently, it was a huge tome and nobody read it. Clifford Terry called it the worst-read, best-selling book in literary history.
Everyone wanted on their shelves to look erudite, but not actually become erudite by reading it.
It was like the 50s version of Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Well, the director of all of these people, of the writer, Pasternak, the actors we've already talked about, David Lean, his third and final AFI film, Bridges of the River Kwai, Lawrence of Arabia, the other two massive hits. He kept taking us out of America, though, ironically, for the AFI, the jungles in Asia, the Middle East, and now Russia. So it's hot and wet, then hot and dry, then stone cold freezing.
Mm-hmm.
Enormous movies that always had big train sequences, major plot devices in all three of his movies. And in fact, in the sequence where Lily Marotti, the woman who tries to get the baby, of course, we learn later that she's just faking it. There's no baby there. She tries to get on the train, though, to get saved. She was hurt during that scene. Or maybe the stunt woman was, but I remember I heard this story years ago. And Lean barely acknowledged it. He was just a tyrant. He was like, we gotta shoot. Gotta make this movie happen. This woman was hurt. didn't even seem to care about that.
As I remember seeing the film, she did have a baby, but the baby was dead already.
Oh, that's what I meant. She knew the kid was dead, and she was faking
that. That much more gruesome, though, that she was using the corpse of a child to get herself a place on the train.
Although, who can really blame her? On that train, talk about bringing some life and some passion to a movie that's often pretty flat and passionless. Well, the movie is a big passion movie all the way through, I guess, but it's also pretty flat. The very infamous Klaus Kinski, known for the Werner Herzog movies, Gary, the Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, all those great movies that he made with him, Nosferatu, where he played the infamous Dracula. And Kinski's not in the movie very long, but he definitely gets things going. He's not a villain. He doesn't have enough of a role to be a villain, although he is in handcuffs, but he definitely gets under people's skin in maybe 15 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, that scene stuck out for me. I actually like that part of the film, the part on the train. You really don't know what's going to happen to them, and their lives have changed so drastically. Again, they take it completely in stride. They're like, yeah, we'll sleep on straw. No biggie. It's not like we gave up a bourgeois life for this.
And he's a doctor.
Yeah, that's right. He's a doctor.
It's that sequence that's pretty saggy, though. There's not much Laura in there. We don't see her for quite a long time, and it really does take a long time for them to get anywhere on that train ride.
That's true. You know, we don't really see much of him practicing as a doctor.
Or being a poet.
No, we see him writing, but...
almost at the very end.
It's such a strange detail. I don't know if the book had the poems or not, but after all that, you think we would have heard one of these infamous poems.
True. Yeah, in the wax house. I say that because it's supposed to be the ice house, but they had to make it out of wax.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful, but it doesn't look even remotely real. Cartoonishly beautiful.
I'm not going to excuse them for that, because if you don't believe in it, then you don't believe in it. But that maybe is an interesting, surreal moment then, because it's almost like this is a moment in time for them, a few days or weeks or however long they're supposed to be there, maybe months. He and Laura steal away with her daughter, not his daughter, but hers, and they have this little life together, and that's one of the times you see her fantastically gorgeous face framed so perfectly by Lean's camera.
Yeah, no showers or anything.
But she's flawless.
But she still looks perfect. Not an eyelash out of place.
And it's finally in those scenes, though, where he's writing some poetry. Maybe it's that he just sits down and writes it all at once. He just pulls a Stephen King and just crams it all in a couple of days. This one thing that was in his head the whole time.
A poet that doesn't poet and a doctor that doesn't doctor.
He does do that some, though. That's...
you see a little bit of him doctoring.
In fact, when he first meets Laura... Yuri and Laura don't actually speak. The movie's almost half over. He does see her earlier. Do you remember what his first line of dialogue is to her?
No.
Are you a nurse?
Oh, right.
But she is a nurse later
on. That's because that's the first time
he first sees her when he's taking care of her mother, and he's just hypnotized from that point on by her beauty. Later actually gets to work with her as a nurse. And then there's that scene that people love. The documentary on the DVD talks about this, too. When she's left him, they're not together, but she's left to go back to, I guess, Komarovsky, and, well, actually, I guess it would have to be her husband, the Tom Courtney character, Pasha, who is the father of her child, and the sunflower is shedding petals as if it's tears.
Yes. Visually, that's where this movie stands out. Touches like that, the cinematography, the mise-en-scene, the sets, the landscapes, it's all really beautiful. Like, this is what Lean does best, and that's probably part of what people like about the movie so much. And that scene with the sunflowers is definitely a great example.
Also, the very infamous red dress that she wears, which Julie Christie hated. But it's this whole suggestion, when you wear a red dress like that, what's that supposed to imply? That Komarovsky's already been sleeping with her. He's supposed to be into her mother. Kind of like Lolita. We have both separately watched Lolita very recently.
Yeah, that's right.
Where James Mason, we said his name earlier in the podcast, who could have played Komarovsky. He's married to Shelley Winters, who thinks the world of him, but he's only ever wanted her daughter.
Yeah.
And it's not really anywhere near as much of a plot point in this movie, but Komarovsky has leanings towards Laura's mother, but no, he wants the young, beautiful blonde instead.
Who's less than half his age. She's practically a child when he meets her.
And when she has that red dress on, pretty suggestive about what that's supposed to imply.
Yeah, I thought it was perfectly transparent. He had already slept with her and got bored of her at that point.
But he does later rape her, even though he denies that's what it is.
Oh yeah, he's so awful.
Another movie reference would be Goodfellas, I would have to say, because Pasha asks her to hide a gun for him. It's a time-honored staple in movies, I guess, now. Hiding a gun for your man.
I know. I was thinking of Lorraine Bracco in that scene.
But getting back to Victor, he has a line where he says to Laura, "You'll always come back." I think he may be right, because is Laura more into security than she is into love? She never really truly chooses Yuri, even though she seems to love him back, and he certainly loves her.
She has good reason to want security. The country is absolutely in tatters, and everybody's suffering, and without security, she's ultimately lost. She's stolen away by the Soviets.
I'm not judging her for it, I'm just saying.
No, she loses her daughter, and she ultimately loses her life. She loses everything without security, so yeah, who could blame her? But she also seemed to actually be genuinely seduced by him. When she's dancing with him, when he takes her on that date, he wins her over.
Mm-hmm. That's the Rod Steiger slyness, I guess.
Yeah, he's not very good looking. He needs something else to work for him.
He's got money and power,
though. He's rich,
though.
Yeah.
Speaking of rich guys, the producer Carlo Ponti, the Italian producer who did Blow Up the year after this, in fact, that came out Michelangelo Antonioni and many Sophie Loren movies. Why not? He was her husband. God, that guy got lucky there. He wanted to duplicate the success that Lean had had on Lawrence of Arabia, so he recruited a lot of the Lawrence of Arabia crew, including the cinematographer Freddie Young, who did work on Lawrence, and also You Only Live Twice, the Bond film. Young is one of those people, much like Peter O'Toole, that was not gunned about working with Lean again after the stresses of Lawrence of Arabia, but he was convinced. Maybe he was convinced by money. I didn't read that part, just speculating.
Money can be very convincing.
And it won Young another Oscar.
Oscars can also be quite convincing.
The possibility of them anyway, yeah. The editor, Norman Savage, the only editor credited on this film. How is that possible on a movie this long that there isn't more than one editor? He was an assistant editor on Lawrence of Arabia, and he also did Ryan's Daughter later on for Lean.
He saved time by not cutting anything out.
He just cut off the heads and the tails of the action and cut scenes.
Yeah,
and
just take out the bad bits. There, we have a film. That was easy.
Rush it into theaters. Get it out there as soon as possible. Well, I'm assuming you didn't think the movie was well edited. For a huge epic, a long epic about a lot of people, what did you think of it in that context?
It's hard to follow. The pacing is uneven.
So then, no.
No, I wouldn't say that. It's so hard to judge that because you never know what an editor is working with. But no, I wouldn't say it's a particularly well edited film.
All right, well, the other controversial behind-the-scenes person, the composer, Maurice Jarre, a lot of people have an issue with him, for sure, with his very famous Lara score and many other things. He had worked on Lawrence of Arabia. He also worked on Witness and Ghost and so many other titles we talked about in plenty on the Lawrence podcast. And that soundtrack, the Laura's theme especially, made this movie that wasn't doing that well become such a big blockbuster. What are your thoughts on the Laura theme? Are you a naysayer or a fan or kind of in the middle?
I don't hate it, but I'm not going to put it on my iTunes playlist anytime soon. All these people complained about it, but by the time the film ended, I wasn't annoyed by it.
Maybe it's overplayed. That's probably why people
so much. Sure, but it's no more overplayed than the theme in The Godfather or any other famous piece of music.
Fair
point. Star Wars theme. I'm not really sure why people found this so annoying.
Fair point. Yeah, okay. Okay, let's get into the influence then. The TV movie in 2002 with Keira Knightley and Sam Neill, the Dr. Zhivago version of that. We talked about Keira Knightley when we did Married for a Lady, when I speculated about who could play a modern version of Eliza.
Mm-hmm.
As I said then, I think it's because I've been reading the trivia for this. Knightley playing Laura. She's beautiful, but she ain't no Julie Christie in her prime. Big influence would have to be on Reds, the Warren Beatty movie. Also a love story with Russian political turmoil as a backdrop. Have you ever seen Reds?
No.
Has a lot of big pluses. Probably as many as this one. Not as famous, not as well known. But even more political than this movie is. If Beatty was influenced by Dr. Zhivago, I'd be very surprised. His girlfriend, maybe she wasn't at that point, but she had been Julie Christie, too.
Oh.
Maybe there's a connection there, whether he meant it to be that way or not. And then any movie that sets a traumatizing love affair against the backdrop of a major war, you could pay homage to Dr. Zhivago for being that. Some movies have really failed badly. The Angelina Jolie, Clive Owen movie, what was it called? Beyond Borders, where their love story is set against the backdrop of genocide or something over in one of the African countries. People trash that movie because of the fact that their love story is more important than the... Pearl Harbor does that, too.
Yeah.
I hate Pearl Harbor for that reason alone. Our love is more important than World War II.
Well, I'm thinking also of English Patient and Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
Also pretty epic films.
And pretty well-respected films. Those other ones I just mentioned, Pearl Harbor and Beyond Borders, were not. But those two you just said certainly were. English Patient won the Oscar for crying out loud. The dear departed Anthony Minghella directed those pictures. Dr. Zhivago won 5 Oscars for the script. Robert Bolt, we didn't talk about him. He wrote, of course, Lawrence of Arabia. So his script won the Oscar. Young cinematography did. The sets, the costumes, and the music. We talked about those 3 awards last week when we did Sound of Music because those were 3 nominations that it didn't win, and it lost those categories to this exact film. 5 other nominations, Best Picture, Best Director for David Lean, Supporting Actor Tom Courtenay, the only one in the cast nominated for an award, the editing, we just talked about that, and the sound. Now, like My Fair Lady a few weeks ago, Congress says, "Niet!" Dr. Zhivago is not in the National Film Registry. We had such a long string where every movie we did was in the National Film Registry at some point, but these 2 of the last 3 or 4 we've done, nope.
I can see why, because it's barely an American film.
That might be a factor. My Fair Lady, as we said in that one, also not really an American film in any significant way, apart from the studio and the producer. And Zhivago, like we said at the very top of this podcast, wasn't the Passions list. It was number 7, which I guess if you're going to ever have any faith in this movie or any belief in this movie, you have to give it that due.
I can't really fault the love story. As a couple, I found them pretty convincing. I always feel weird about judging the Passions category because I suspect that they're just talking about an appeal in films that just doesn't really work on me. I love romance, or I think I love romance.
But you don't love the AFI's version of romance.
Yeah, I don't love the sappy, melodramatic version of romance.
And a lot of the ones on the top 100 list.
Yeah.
Or the Passions list, anyway, are that. 39th in the first list. As I've said before, when I first saw this movie, I would have been okay with that. Now, no way. But it drops off. That's 61, well, more than 61 places it drops off. No film had a bigger drop. Birth of a Nation was close at 44th to not being on the list. Whether you liked it or not, does that surprise you?
It surprises me more that it was 39th on the first list. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there was some, not outrage, but some, what? Really? 39? Like, I wonder if some critics were kind of shamed into maybe watching it again and second-guessing where they put it on the list.
And it's one of the many ones we've covered lately where if we weren't doing this specifically for the project, I wouldn't have said to you, let's watch Josh Zhivago next week. Maybe we would have eventually seen it, but there's no way it would have been a must-see the way some of the other ones we've covered have been. Lean's 3 movies, we're done with him now. I think he'll agree with me. There's a descending level of quality. Not that Lawrence of Arabia is a great quality film. We had that big debate in that movie whether or not we really truly liked it. I had more of an issue with saying that than you did. But Bridge is an unquestioned classic for us. Lawrence, as great as it is not a movie that we really want to see again. And this one definitely don't want to see again.
Yeah, people seem to like Lawrence of Arabia more, but I, without question, think that Bridge on the River Kwai is a better movie. And Dr. Zhivago, out of the three, is most certainly at the bottom of that list.
All right, well, I think we've trashed this movie enough. So many people do love it, obviously. But next week, we have a whole different kind of love story, and it is our third view of Elizabeth Taylor and our only glimpse of Richard Burton in the fiery, also very passionate, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I love this movie.
A movie that was overlooked the first list. Maybe it flopped with Dr. Zhivago. Zhivago was on, then it wasn't. Virginia Woolf wasn't, then it was. So the coming attraction trivia for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Director Mike Nichols' first 2 movies, this one and The Graduate, made the top 100. How many other Nichols pictures were nominated for the top 100?
So for the answer to that, tune in to next week's podcast. And if you'd like more trivia, lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, including links to some of the things we've talked about, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of Dr. Zhivago? Do you disagree with us in our cynical view of this romantic movie? Please let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, we'd like to warmly thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee.
This is Boris Pasternak speaking. You two missed the entire point of this film, so shut up.
We very well may have. And cut.